the top stories, Israeli forces enter scores of Palestinians near the West Bank city of Nablus amid tensions in the occupied territories. Ukraine's defense minister says the probability of a major escalation with Russia is low, despite the U.S. allegation of an imminent Russian invasion. And a major strike paralyzes most of Paris' metro network and train grid, disrupting daily commutes of millions of people as workers demand pay hikes. My name is Arash Zahidi. Welcome. The Palestinian Red Crescent Society says nearly 90 Palestinians have been injured after Israeli forces attacked anti-settlement protesters near the occupied West Bank city of Nablus. The protests erupted in the town of Beita and Beit Dajan, south of Nablus. In Beita, Israeli forces clashed with Palestinians who were protesting the visit of a group of Israeli settlers to their village. Elsewhere in the West Bank, the regime's forces stopped hundreds of Palestinians near a checkpoint in Ramallah, preventing them from reaching Al-Aqsa Mosque. The situation is tense across the occupied West Bank amid an Israeli crackdown in the Sheikh Jarrah neighborhood of Al-Quds city. Anger boils after a far-right Israeli lawmaker opened an office in the neighborhood over the weekend. Two Palestinians have been killed in ensuing demonstrations. Our Ramallah correspondent Mona Kandil gave us more details about the clashes near Nablus.
There was a call from settlers, organizations to head to Nablus, specifically to Sbeh Mountain in the village of Beita. This area that witnessed numerous clashes and ongoing protests and demonstrations against the building of an illegal settlement there. What happened today is that there was a call by the settlers group to tour the area by the settlers and settlers officials as well. That's why Palestinians from the village of Beita and the villages surrounding headed to Sbeh Mountain and performed the Fajr prayers there. After that, there were clashes between the Palestinians and the Israeli settlers that, of course, the Israeli soldiers rushed to the area to make sure they would be protecting the Israeli settlers.
Saudi Arabia launches yet another airstrike on Yemen, this time targeting Sana'a province. At least one civilian was killed in the latest attack that took place in the early hours of Friday. It followed another strike that hit Hajja province. No reports have come out yet about the Hajja attack. Saudi Arabia and its allies launched a war on Yemen in March of 2015, devastating the country's key infrastructure. The conflict has left hundreds of thousands of Yemenis dead, mostly civilians. Millions more have been displaced, while half of the population there faces hunger. The UN says Yemen is now the largest humanitarian crisis in the world. The UN warns that millions of Yemenis face more cuts in humanitarian aid in coming months because of funding shortages that could reduce food rations in the war-torn country. Abdul Latif al-Washali is in Sana'a.
The United Nations aid chief Martin Griffiths said the humanitarian operations in Yemen is about to start doing a lot less. In his latest briefing to the UN Security Council, he warned that the aid agencies are quickly running out of money, forcing them to slash life-saving programs. His remarks has sparked harsh reactions in Yemen.
The UN's decision to cut humanitarian aid threatens the lives of millions of Yemenis. The United Nations is subject to the conditions of donors, most of whom are from the countries of the Saudi-led coalition, and therefore they are politicizing humanitarian aid to achieve what they have failed militarily. The United Nations describes the situation in Yemen as the world's worst humanitarian crisis, and Yemenis have been suffering since the beginning of the war, and the UN aid is already scarce.
Since January, the World Food Program has reduced rations for 8 million of the 13 million Yemenis it feeds each month. Griffiths said rations may be cut further from March or even stopped, meaning that millions of Yemenis may die of hunger.
When we see the reality and what is happening on the ground and how the Yemeni army continues to achieve victories in various battlefronts, we realize that the Saudi-led coalition has failed to achieve its declared goals, and therefore they are seeking to put pressure on the Yemeni army by reducing humanitarian aid to the country. Reports confirm the high rate of death among children, and this confirms the failure of the United Nations humanitarian operation in Yemen.
The reduction in food rations comes with millions of people in Yemen facing starvation as a result of the ongoing years-long Saudi war and the blockade imposed on their country. As observers say, the United Nations may announce a death sentence for millions of Yemenis if gaps in its funding are not filled. They warn that if the world body wants to save more lives in Yemen, it must reduce the operational expenses of its agencies that deplete the humanitarian funding. Abdul Latif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
While the West keeps accusing Russia of planning to invade Ukraine, Kyiv itself sees the probability of a large-scale escalation as low. That's what Ukraine's defense minister has told parliament. Neighboring Russia also says it's withdrawing more troops and equipment from near Ukraine's borders. Citing the presence of Russian forces there, the U.S. and NATO have been insisting for weeks now that Russia wants to attack Ukraine. Moscow denies that allegation. In the meantime, it has expressed concern over the latest flare-up in eastern Ukraine between pro-Russian fighters and government troops. Both sides have accused each other of shelling and mortar attacks and thus violating a ceasefire in place since February of 2015. The pro-Russian forces based in the Donbass region seek independence from Ukraine. Political commentator John Bosnich says the recent Russian military drills are aimed at warning Kyiv against any attack on ethnic Russians in eastern Ukraine.
Well, I think that quite a few people have realized that Russia's maneuvers outside of Ukraine, inside Russian territory, have been primarily aimed at letting Ukraine understand that further attacks on the ethnic Russian sections and areas of Ukraine would possibly result in Russian protection of those people. And I think that we can see here that Ukraine could be attempting to provoke Russian activity. Now, the people have known for quite some time that the government or the authorities in Kyiv do not like the Minsk peace process and do not plan to fulfill the Minsk terms. Russia has been demanding for some time that those terms be followed through on. There's been no response from Kyiv, and this could be an effort, a last-ditch effort by Kyiv to provoke a conflict which would bring in the United States and bring in other Western forces on its side.
Transport workers go on a major strike in Paris, bringing most of the city's subway network to a halt. 8 metro lines are completely out of service, while 6 others are operating only partially. The French transport minister has called on companies to make maximum use of working from home while the walkouts continue. Employees of RATP, the Paris Rail and Metro system, are unhappy with their wage hike this year. The government has offered to increase their pay by 2.7%, but what they're asking for is 3%. The French capital has been hit by a number of major strikes in the transport sector in the past few years. Iran and the remaining signatories to the 2015 deal known as the JCPOA hold more talks in the Austrian capital to revive the accord. Tehran is seeking a verifiable removal of Washington's anti-Iran sanctions. Our correspondent in Vienna, Homa Lesgi, joined us earlier with an update.
This morning there was a meeting between the head of Iran's delegation, Mr. Ali Bagherikani, and the EU coordinator, Enrica Mora. And we just also heard last night from Russian Ambassador Mikhail Oryanov that he believes the sides still need time in order to be able to resolve the outstanding issues. And Mr. Ulyanov has also recently tweeted saying that as we get closer to a final agreement and the final stages of the negotiations, in his words, opponents are becoming more proactive and are trying to create an unhealthy atmosphere in the public space as these talks are reaching the last or final stage. And this could be a reference to certain reports that have been circulating in the media about, for instance, the contents of a possible agreement, the contents and what the draft would entail, etc. And those reports, of course, have been rejected or dismissed by Iranian officials and sources. And as we know, one of the advisors to the Iranian negotiating team, Professor Mohammad Marandi, has also said that those reports are not credible. And when talks conclude, and if that happens, we will see the deeply flawed nature of these reports. And he's also said that some Europeans are hampering progress by introducing demands that go beyond Iran's JCPOA commitments. So this is also what we've been hearing from other sources close to the Iranian negotiating team. They've been also suggesting that some of the sides, presumably the Europeans, are putting forward last-minute demands or making requests that go beyond the framework and the commitments that have been outlined in the 2015 agreement known as the JCPOA.
A senior Iranian official has warned Europe that its support for the terrorist Mojahedin-e Khalq organization will come at a price, just as it did with Daesh. Kazem Gharibabadi says it's disgraceful that European lawmakers are turning a blind eye to MKO crimes for their own political interests. The Secretary of Iran's High Council for Human Rights says Europe and the United States have committed the biggest crime against the Iranian nation through support for terrorist groups as well as illegal sanctions. Gharibabadi stresses that European countries must be accountable for their human rights violations and are in no position to preach others in this regard. Around 12,000 Iranians have fallen victim to the MKO acts of terror over the past four decades. The terrorist group is currently based in Albania, where it enjoys freedom of activity after being delisted by the EU and the United States in 2009 and 2012, respectively.
The MKO terrorist group appears to be expanding its operations to include trafficking, among other criminal activities. An Albanian historian and journalist says the country's police have alerted the U.S. Embassy that members of the terrorist organization are involved in various criminal activities in Europe, including human trafficking, with possible links to the Daesh Takfiri terrorist group. Alsi Jazeshi, citing Albanian media reports, says the MKO operatives, headed by the terrorist ringleader Mariam Rajavi and based in a camp near the capital Tirana, have attempted to traffic over 400 of the group's own members to France. Jazeshi added that a number of the terrorist cult's members have been detained for trafficking people from the Middle East to Europe, who were most likely Daesh terrorists. The journalist also says some senior MKO members, including the ringleader's sister-in-law, have been arrested while trying to traffic drugs into Italy, with police having prosecuted another member over theft charges. The Albanian police deny sending any letter to the American embassy without elaborating further. The journalist says the terror group has forced an Albanian media outlet to take down an article it published about the arrests.
They used Albania as a safe haven to carry out illegal activities and criminal acts. And now they are becoming a problem for Greece, Italy, Germany, and France. And when I say problem, not just trafficking human beings, drugs, money laundering, and some other activities. They have become a problem for Albania for the crimes I just mentioned, but also burglary, pickpocketing, harassing women, sexual harassment, and at least one case of rape.
Critics in Albania blame the United States and its Western allies for providing protection for the terrorist cult.
Since the 1979 Islamic Revolution in Iran, almost 17,000 Iranians have lost their lives in terror attacks there. Nearly 12,000 have been killed in attacks by the MKO alone. The terrorist group is also notorious for its extremely suppressive control over members in the camps, or in its own camps. Despite that, the U.S. has continued to support the group, which expanded its anti-Iran operations under former President Donald Trump.
Mujahideen Khalq Organization, MKO, also known as the MEK, is a notorious anti-Iran terror group that embraces an ideology that mixes Marxism and terrorism. MKO's crimes against Iran run the gamut from collaborating with Iraq's former dictator Saddam Hussein during the 1980 to 1988 war on Iran to a violent campaign of bombings across the country. One of the group's highest profile acts of terror came on June 28, 1981, when a powerful bomb went off at the headquarters of an Iranian political party, the Islamic Republican Party, where the party's leaders were holding a meeting. The bombing killed scores of Iranian officials, including the then head of Supreme Judicial Council, Ayatollah Mohammad Beheshti. Most recently, Iran said there were traces of MKO involvement in the assassination of Iran's top scientist Mohsen Fakhrizadeh in November 2020. The anti-Iran organization has long been recognized as a terror group by much of the international community. However, in June 2008, the United Kingdom crossed the group off its terror list. The move was followed by the European Union in 2009 and the United States in 2012. Canada followed in the footsteps of the Western countries in delisting MKO as a terror group in December 2012 without offering any reason for the decision.
Some of them have their hands stained with blood. Some of them have battlefield experience. Some of them have some formal training by Mukhabarat, the special secret police of Saddam Hussein. So they are not just two people trying to go to Europe to make a living. They are a danger. Criminals need to go to prison. Not to roam in the streets of European cities. Absolutely. This is my idea.
Since removing their decade-long ban on the MKO, the Western nations, especially the United States, have used the group as a tool to pressure Iran. But the latest revelations about the terror organization can serve as a wake-up call for its Western supporters that the threats they have been brewing against Iran will backfire on them.
And that's it with international news.
Join us in this journey. IRIB English Radio.
Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
in the limelight.
As early voting continues in Texas primary election, pro-democracy advocates are sounding the alarm over the high rate at which mail-in ballots are being rejected as a result of the GOP's newly enacted voter suppression law. Stay with us for an article in this regard, written by Kenny Stancil, journalist. This article is published under the heading, GOP Law Blamed as Nearly 40% of Mail-in Ballots Rejected in Houston Area. Here's more. As early voting continues in Texas primary election, pro-democracy advocates are sounding the alarm over the high rate at which mail-in ballots are being rejected as a result of the GOP's newly enacted voter suppression law. Election officials in Harris County said they had returned almost 2,500 of the 6,548 mail-in ballots received due to cumbersome new ID rules, a rejection rate of nearly 38% in Texas' most populous county, a Democratic stronghold that includes Houston and more than 2.4 million voters. Civil rights advocates have pointed to a record number of mail-in ballot rejections during the opening days of early voting in Texas' 2022 primaries as evidence of the effectiveness of the Republican Party's draconian voter suppression law, Senate Bill 1. Mail ballots are people's votes, Isabel Longoria, the Harris County Elections Administrator, told NPR. So I am very concerned not just with the complexity of the process, but how that added complexity is going to increase the number of mail ballots that we have to reject, she added. Texas already had some of the nation's most restrictive voting rules, but last year the GOP controlled the state legislature and Republican Governor Greg Abbott approved sweeping changes, including new ID requirements for mail-in ballots, a ban on drive-through voting, and limits on counties' ability to expand voting options that critics warned would make voting even harder. Emerging data shows those worries were warranted. Texas only allows people who are 65 and older, disabled, out of town, or in jail to vote by mail. Under Senate Bill 1, the ID used to request and return a mail-in ballot, whether it is a driver's license number or partial social security number, must match what is on a voter's registration record. This requirement has already derailed thousands of voters who didn't remember which ID they used to register, often several years ago, when requesting mail-in ballots. As of 1 month ago, roughly half of mail-in voting applications had been rejected in Travis County, Texas' fifth largest county and home of the state capital, Austin, as Common Dreams reported. The Texas Tribune reported late last week that even counties that saw few request rejections are now grappling with high rates of faulty ballots. That includes Hays County, where about 30% of the voters who had already returned their mail-in ballots had not filled out the ID requirement, noted the Tribune. Those are early figures as ballots are only starting to trickle in. So Jennifer Anderson, the county's elections administrator, is hoping voter outreach efforts will help curb more errors. Anderson said, "We usually have a very low rejection rate, so it's not something we want to see in Hays County." The Tribune added that other suburban counties are seeing similar rates. Election officials in Williamson County said about 30% of completed ballots were missing ID numbers. According to the newspaper, the ID requirements forced a redesign of the carrier envelopes used to return mail-in ballots, allowing them to be sealed in any way that protects a voter's sensitive information while traveling through the mail. The ID field was placed under the envelope flat. But based on early figures, local election officials said they feared voters were missing it altogether. While voters are permitted to fix ballot issues, the window to do so is narrow and rapidly closing with Election Day just 2 weeks away. Officials expect to see more mistakes between now and March 1st, when the vast majority of mail-in ballots arrive. Whether voters are made aware of errors in a timely manner depends in large part on the existence of resources that vary widely across Texas' 254 counties. As the Tribune explained, defective ballots must be sent back to voters if they arrive early enough to be sent back and corrected. If officials determine there is not enough time, they must notify the voter by phone or email. Voters must then visit the elections office in person to correct the issue or use the state's new online ballot tracker to verify the missing information. Heather Hawthorne, the county clerk of Chambers County, told the newspaper, "Obviously, the main concern, I think, with most election officials is that people that receive ballots by mail may not have the ability to come to the clerk's office." After Abbott signed Senate Bill 1 into law in September, rights groups took legal action arguing that the changes would disproportionately impact the poor, the elderly, people with disabilities, and people of color. The Biden Justice Department also filed a lawsuit alleging that the new restrictions violate the Civil Rights Act of 1964 and the Voting Rights Act. Although parts of the Senate Bill 1 have been temporarily blocked in the courts, much of the Texas GOP anti-voter law is now in effect. Amid the state's first major election since the legislation was enacted, the potential for disenfranchisement is becoming increasingly apparent, according to underground reports. Senate Bill 1 is part of a nationwide assault on the franchise by state-level Republicans that includes map rigging, new voter identification laws, and a reduction in early voting and polling places and hours. According to the Brennan Center for Justice, at least 19 states passed 34 laws restricting access to voting in 2021, a tidal wave of voter suppression that shows no sign of slowing down as the nation heads into the 2022 midterm and, before too long, campaigns for the 2024 general election. As of January 14th, according to the latest tally from the Brennan Center, legislators in at least 27 states have introduced, pre-filed, or carried over 250 bills with restrictive provisions. The GOP's attack on democracy has been fueled by an avalanche of lies about voter fraud and stolen election repeated ad nauseum by former President Donald Trump and other right-wing figures. Voting rights advocates have argued that the best way to counter GOP voter suppression efforts is by passing two pieces of federal legislation, the Freedom to Vote Act and the John R. Lewis Voting Rights Advancement Act. Those bills have stalled in Congress, however, due to the opposition of every Republican and a pair of right-wing Democratic senators.
This is A to Z. An introduction to Islamic lifestyle. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. In the name of Allah, the Most Beneficent, the Most Merciful. Dear brothers and sisters, Assalamu alaikum. Peace and blessings of Allah be upon you all.
This is A to Z, coming to you from IRIB English Radio, and I'm your host, Ali. This radio show is about Islamic lifestyle, and in each episode, we will be talking about a different lesson. Please stay with us till the end of today's program. Today's lesson: two things cause destruction. If we consider the causes of increase in transgression, larcenies, theft, cheating, and plundering, we find that the following two factors are the root of all these events. Some people, having everything, commit offenses only for the fear of poverty and obsession for securing the future. And some others sacrifice their peace of mind and soul in order to acquire fanciful honors. Giving up these destructive traits allow man to enjoy inner peace and happiness. Imam Ali alayhi salam has said, "Two things destroy people: fear of poverty and seeking of fanciful honors." Brothers and sisters, when we look at our own lives, let's just introspect for a while, you know, and then look at people around us, look at the society we live in. Aren't these two factors playing a vital role in changing our worldview and changing our decision-making process? Do we not run after wealth, even if we have enough and sufficient for ourselves? Why? Because we fear poverty. And then at the same time, we spend all that wealth just for those fanciful, artificial, and superficial honors. We want to be respected in the society. These things are prevalent issues of contemporary society, which is based on materialism. Welcome back, dear listeners. Today we want to discuss this thing a bit more, where the fear of poverty is destroying our societies. Well, how do we treat this? What needs to be done in order for people to come out of this whirlpool, right? We're going to list out a few of the ideas just to get you thinking about the solutions to this potential issue of our societies. The first one is teaching people to believe truly that provisions come from Allah. Allah is the Raziq. Allah is the provider. Number two, seeking refuge with Allah from poverty. You know, poverty is not something that we should be seeking. No, of course, we need to avoid it. But how do we avoid it? By running after the world? No, we have to seek refuge in Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala and make sure that we don't get deceived by this evil of the society. Number three, encouragement to work and earn a living and to travel in the land to seek provision. Number four, making zakah obligatory on the wealth of the rich. This Islamic taxes, zakat and khums, you know, these are the Islamic taxes. If they're made obligatory, it solves a lot of the problems we see in the society. Number five, encouragement to give charity. Set up waqfs and sponsor orphans and widows. Number six, prohibition on riba, usury, gambling, and deceit in selling. These are the diseases of human society. Last but not the least for today's program is encouragement to help the needy and support the weak. Dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, thank you very much for staying with us till the end of today's episode of A to Z. Don't forget to log on to our website at www.parsi.com. ParsToday.com, Call of Islam page. We leave you all in the care of Allah. Till next time, wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Is there any other way to get familiar with Islam besides mainstream media? Try IRIB English Radio. Log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
In the limelight.
Biden is crushing the Afghan economy by seizing $3.5 billion of its people's money and diverting the other $3.5 billion for a trust fund to benefit the Afghan people. Stay with us for an article in this regard written by Austin Allman, Ryder. This article is published under the heading Biden's Decision on Frozen Afghanistan Money is Tantamount to Mass Murder. Stay tuned for more. After making the initial decision last summer to withdraw U.S. forces from Afghanistan, the Biden administration announced recently that it intends to split the Afghan central bank's assets, which are held in the possession of the New York Federal Reserve Bank, between the families of 9/11 victims and unspecified efforts for the benefit of the Afghan people. The decision puts Biden on track to cause more death and destruction in Afghanistan than was caused by the 20 years of war that he ended. For months, the administration has been debating how the future of economic relations with the Taliban-controlled Afghanistan will look like. The assets, which were initially frozen when the Taliban seized control of the country in August, are essential for the liquidity and basic functionality of the economy. With the administration's lack of firm commitment to return the assets to the central bank, which American economists who helped design and still help to run say is still independent from the Taliban, the Afghan people will be reliant on humanitarian aid for the foreseeable future. Already, reports say aid is not enough to prevent the precipitous decline in living conditions the Afghan people are facing. The problem is one of the basic economics. Seizing the central bank funds has brought economic activity to a standstill. People have lost access to money held in banks. Government workers and teachers are going without paychecks. Importers have no access to capital to front the imports. Exporters similarly can't access capital to keep their businesses operating. The currency, the Afghani, has collapsed in value, and inflation is much steeper in Afghanistan than the rest of the world as a result. A White House spokesperson said the administration would create a trust fund to benefit the Afghan people in a variety of ways. In the last few months, as House Democrats squabbled over the wording of letters and senators balked at questions about America's responsibility for the crisis, the situation on the ground in Afghanistan has rapidly devolved. Multiple international organizations have warned that these conditions have pushed nearly 10 million Afghans to the brink of starvation. To survive, people are burning their furniture and other possessions to stay warm or selling them for good. While those 20 years of war, an irregularly long drought, and an especially severe winter have set the stage for the crisis, the proximate cause of the Afghan people's suffering is the seizure of Afghan assets, coupled with sanctions imposed by the United States regime. Members of Congress have been slow in coming to grips with the effects of the Biden administration's policy in the region. In December, Representatives Pramila Jayapal, Cha Garcia, and Sarah Jacobs led over 40 of their colleagues in a letter to the administration that stressed the need for conscientiously but urgently modifying current U.S. policy regarding the freeze of Afghanistan's foreign reserves and ongoing sanctions. Last week, Jayapal, the leader of the Congressional Progressive Caucus, sponsored an amendment to the America Competes Act on the sanctions. While it did not call for an end to the U.S. sanctions regime, it would have set up the groundwork for Congress to formally study the disastrous effects of economic policies. While House Democrats could have muscled the amendment through their own votes, 44 of them joined every House Republican to block its passage. The Intercept contacted each of those 44 Democrats, and not one of them would provide an on-record explanation for why they opposed studying the devastation Afghans are facing as a result of U.S. policies. With the amendment's failure, legislative action to address the crisis appears stalled for the time being, though Jayapal expressed optimism that the vote could be a precursor to an easing of U.S. restrictions. In an interview with The Intercept recently, she said the caucus felt it was a victory to win the vast majority of Democrats in a vote that, for the first time, really took on the humanitarian effects of these sanctions. Her office did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the Biden administration announcement. A senior Democratic foreign policy aide who was granted anonymity to openly share his thoughts on the Biden administration's action said the policy effectively amounts to mass murder. According to the aide, Biden has had warnings from the UN Secretary General, the International Rescue Committee, and the Red Cross, with a unanimous consensus that the liquidity of the central bank is of paramount importance and no amount of aid can compensate for the destruction of Afghanistan's financial system and the whole macroeconomy. Mark Wisbrot, co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, agreed with the characterizations of Biden's decision as mass starvation. "Most people don't understand the economics of Biden's devastating decision," he told The Intercept. "If a country doesn't have reserves and it doesn't have a functioning central bank, then there is no amount of aid that's going to come anywhere close to making up for that." Recently, after months of insistence from human rights activists and international non-governmental organizations, Congress finally began to debate the United States' role in the rapidly escalating humanitarian crisis in Afghanistan. In a long-overdue hearing in the Senate Foreign Affairs Subcommittee that governs the West Asia, Subcommittee Chair Chris Murphy acknowledged that humanitarian aid alone would not be enough to prevent the rapidly approaching death of thousands of Afghans. Murphy did not directly call for a shift in U.S. policy during the hearing, but he said in an interview with The Intercept that the administration will need to ease sanctions and unfreeze some Afghan assets to mitigate the crisis. "I believe that it's time for us to release the money," he said. Though he reiterated concerns over whether the Afghan central bank can remain truly independent for long under Taliban rule. The only other senator to publicly call for these actions is Senator Bernie Sanders, who tweeted his position on the matter last month. Neither senator's office responded immediately to a request for comment on Biden's decision. Other senators have mostly dismissed questions about America's complicity in a potential Afghan genocide. In interviews with Intercept over the last week, several typically outspoken liberal senators have demurred or rejected the premise of questions about U.S. sanctions regime. Senator Tammy Duckworth, a veteran of America's war in Iraq, denied hearing about the many reports indicating that humanitarian assistance alone will prove insufficient in aiding Afghans. Senator Tammy Baldwin pointed to the Taliban's prior refusal to allow women and girls to attend school and work to justify Biden's policies, but said she would further study reports confirming that since assuming power in August, the Taliban has continued to allow women to maintain a role in public life. And vocal progressive Senator Mazie Hernot responded to a question about the devastation wrought by sanctions and frozen assets with a question of her own. "We're still talking about Afghanistan?" In the subcommittee hearing this week, International Rescue Committee President and CEO David Miliband and International Crisis Group consultant Graeme Smith both gave full-throated condemnations of the international community's financial policies in Afghanistan. Together, the two dispelled the arguments that humanitarian aid could compensate for normalizing economic relations with Afghanistan and rebutted those who point to the cruelties of the groups to justify. Together, the two dispelled the arguments that humanitarian aid could compensate for normalizing economic relations with Afghanistan and rebutted to those who point to the cruelties of the Taliban to justify the cruelties inflicted by the Western countries.
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1520 to 1620 UTC on the following frequencies. 41 meters, 7,300 kilohertz for the Indian subcontinent, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or BAD 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is pastoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program, P.O. Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about our audio quality and other means. Thank you.
Every night and every day, every night and every day, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah, never forget to say, La ilaha illallah.
IRIB English Radio, herald of unity and solidarity amongst Islamic denominations.
Oh Lord, here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure.
Hadith of the day.
Here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more, no more.
You're listening to the program Hadith of the Day with Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha on IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Welcome to our program Hadith of the Day here at IRIB English Radio. Today on Hadith of the Day, we are going to be looking at a very beautiful tradition which has been narrated from Imam Ali alayhi salam regarding the evil characteristic of showing off, which in Arabic we call Riya. This is one of those very evil characteristics, and it is one of the characteristics that can lead to other, you know, bad results, such as, for example, the canceling of our act of worship, which we might have performed with the intent of showing off. So this is a characteristic that we want to shun and forego and adopt in its place, its opposite, which is sincerity with respect to God Almighty. Let's look at this beautiful tradition and read it for you here today. Imam Ali alayhi salam says, O Allah, so this is a dua and a prayer that Imam Ali is making in order to protect himself from riya. So not only is this a good hadith, tells us about showing off and why it's bad, but also we can use this as a prayer if we feel within us the characteristic of showing off. We feel that we're showing off for people, we want to get rid of this characteristic. We can make this prayer, it can help us perhaps, you know, and can facilitate the elimination of this characteristic from us. Imam Ali says, O Allah, I seek refuge in you from looking good in the gleaming mirror of people's eyes, whilst my inward self that I conceal from others be ugly in front of you, and from guarding myself against sin only for show in front of people, whilst you know all there is to know about me, such that I may display my good side to people, leaving the bad deeds for you. Somebody might say here that Imam Ali is an infallible. He's a perfect human being. He doesn't sin. He doesn't have any bad deeds. So what exactly is he doing? Right, so this is something, obviously, a subject that should be discussed in theological discussions, right? But just we don't have time to enter into this discussion in depth. But we might say that a lot of different answers and responses have been given to this objection by our respectable scholars, one of which is that perhaps the imam, yes, it's true, he doesn't have any bad deeds, but he's making such prayers in order to teach us, fallible people, how to address God and how to repent, how to seek refuge in God from this evil vice of showing off. And this is one answer. Maybe other answers could also be given. Well, of course, we'll forego that discussion for its own proper place. In continuation, the imam says, such that I may display my good side to people, leaving the bad deeds for you. In seeking nearness to mere servants of yours and getting further and further away from your good pleasure. Right? So that when we show off, right, by doing a good deed, so not only is the bad deed that we, not only is the showing off canceling the good deed that we might have done, but also it's distancing us from God, it's distancing us and removing us from God's proximity. Further, we become further and further away from God, right? So it has this evil effect upon us. We ask refuge from God from this evil trait. Thank you for joining us here on Hadith of the Day. We were looking at showing off in the words of Imam Ali alayhi salam.
That was Dr. Shiraz Hossein Agha for the program Hadith of the Day on RIB English Radio.
Here I am, pleading at your door. Send me your mercy, send me your peace, or I am lost for sure. Oh Lord, here I am, yearning for your cure. This humble servant will be diverted from you no more, no more.
Doing us now from Ontario, Canada.
Now back to our story.
What is it in there?
We will be talking about this.
Let me bring in Leo Sazdi. He's a professor of international.
The Spotlight.